morning. Good morning, brother. I want to, first of all, thank you for not only being willing to participate remotely, but also for your patience this morning. We are running a little bit behind because of a fire alarm that went off at the MJC this morning, so we had to take a break. But we are ready to commence with your argument. And I'm going to run through some things just to make sure that we're on the same page. I can hear you fine. I am using a headset, so that probably accounts for the difference in volume. If someone is too quiet, that's a problem. So ask us to speak up and we will. I'll try not to be too loud as I talk through the headset. I want to make sure you're able to see the time that you have remaining. So there should be a clock, and sometimes you have to toggle the view to see it better. But if you're not able to see that, let us know. I also want to reiterate that if there are other interruptions, technical difficulties, that sort of thing, we will do our best to accommodate that and make sure that you have all the time to which you're entitled. And with that, I'll ask the marshal to call the final case that is scheduled for oral argument.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Cochran, Judge Gaitas, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. This case is A21-1467, Carrie Ann Visser, and on behalf of Desiree May McPhail and DJM, versus Blair E. Wilprecht.
Go ahead, Mr. Mack.
John Mack for Mr. Wilprecht. First, I have actually a question for the court. Ordinarily, when the respondent is not represented, the court looks at these cases on the record. I have not gotten any indication, though I may have overlooked it, that she is now represented by counsel.
I'm not sure what your question is. I think you can verify whether someone's represented or not by looking on Mensis. We're here to hear your argument this morning, and you've got now 14 minutes and 20 seconds remaining to tell us anything you'd like to tell us about the case.
Sure. Just as in the case of disorderly conduct, cases involving orders for harassment raise First Amendment problems. We're talking about a person using words, probably in a very obnoxious manner, to attempt to get the other party to remove stakes, to remove trailer houses, and so forth. Since there were neither party was represented, there are a number of things that would be nice to know, like the geography of the house. I'm worried, for example, that the court's order, keeping my client 100 feet away from the house, in this case, blocks his entrance on Lead Road. But be that as it may, it's perfectly clear from Kelty versus Minneapolis that you cannot put things on a right-of-way which blocks, for example, access to a house or endangers a person. It's very dangerous when you're on a motorcycle on a gravel road at night down a very narrow passage that you can go off the road and hit one of the stakes, or you can go off the road and hit the trailer house. So my client was justifiably angry. Now, in order for an order for harassment to ensue, my client's actions must affect the safety or security or privacy of the respondent and her children in this case. And there's no indication really that any of these things were the case. He did not threaten her. There may have been a couple of things that could be construed as veiled threats. But since
Mr. Mack, you say there's no indication, but the district court made a finding that based on the testimony at the hearing, made several findings about the conduct of the appellant, and also found that the harassment has or is intended to have a substantial adverse effect on petitioner's safety, security, or privacy. So it sounds to me you're asking us to reweigh the evidence, but that's not our role.
Well, what I'm asking the court to do is take a look at the transcript, and I'm arguing that regardless of what findings the court made, there is no justifiable finding that the safety of the respondents was affected, that their security or their privacy was affected. I don't think security or privacy are particularly in play here. So we go back to the safety issue. And so, in order for the safety issue to
Are you arguing that the district court's factual findings are clearly erroneous?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that because your brief didn't set forth the standard of review, and it wasn't entirely clear to me whether you were making a legal argument or arguing that the evidence wasn't sufficient to support the district court's
findings. I'm arguing a hybrid. I am saying that the findings, the evidence does not justify the findings, but on the legal argument, I'm saying that we're dealing with these findings under a strict construction kind of theory, because we are implicating the First Amendment, and because we're implicating the First Amendment, the threat to safety has to be clear. And I don't see anything in the record that justifies the court making a finding that the safety of the respondents in this case was in question. One of the problems you're dealing with in this case is that there is no doubt that what my client did was obnoxious. But very often in disorderly conduct cases and in the cases which deal with the First Amendment and harassment type cases, it has to be explicit and it has to be clear. And in this case, it isn't. What did he do? Well, he swore in a loud voice at the respondents in this case. He pulled up stakes and threw them off the right-of-way. But he didn't stalk the respondents. He did not threaten the respondents. And he did not take any assaultive action which would have effectuated their safety.
Mr. Mack, can you cite us any case that requires stalking or assault in order for harassment to be found?
Oh, I'm not claiming that. I'm claiming something different. I'm claiming that those were not found by the court, so they're not in practice in play. The only thing that's in play with regard to 609-748 is repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures that have a substantial adverse effect or are intended to have a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, or privacy of another. So that's the only basis, and that was the only basis that the court found. And because it's the only basis that the court found in a case like this, it was insufficient. Oh, darn it. So a couple of other important things. The respondents in this case are not without a remedy. For example, the respondent could have told my client to go and never return, the magic words that trigger the trespass statutes. I'm unmuting that. My secretary is out on vacation, so I'm playing a dual role. There is even some indication in this case that that the respondent was annoying my client, and obviously my client is easily annoyed. But the stakes are a hazard. The trailer house was a hazard, and under Kelty, these things should have been moved. She never told my client, hey, do not come onto my property. Probably should have at some point. So it seems to me that as we're looking at a case where although what my client did is the kind of thing that bothers a lot of people, it's not the kind of thing that is a clear danger to the safety.
Mr. Mack, if I can interrupt and ask a quick question about some of these facts, in particular, there's a statement that your client stated or made about the petitioner having a death wish.
Well,
How would a reasonable person understand that statement?
It could be taken in a number of ways. It could be taken as you're doing things here which are eventually going to get you into trouble with someone. It could be taken as a threat. But the problem is, at worst, it's a veiled threat. And we're talking about First Amendment issues, and we're talking about the kind of thing that would stand up in court as being a clear threat. It isn't.
In conjunction with other circumstances, could it become less veiled?
It could become somewhat less veiled, but on the other hand, it could become more veiled because these people interacted a lot. He yelled at her a lot. He did at other things a lot, and never once did he hit her. Did he make a pass to hit her, or did he threaten to hit her? So it's also reasonable that she might subjectively have thought, he's just blowing off his steam.
What did the district court find about his words and gestures in terms of whether they were, you said he didn't make a pass to hit her. What did the district court find about his actions, gestures, words, as it relates to her safety, security, and privacy?
Here's the problem. He found that his actions prejudiced her safety, security, and privacy, but he didn't say how. He had about a one-paragraph statement analyzing the case. And
What about the findings regarding aggressive verbal conduct accompanied by quick body movements, frequent use of the F word?
Well, let's start out with frequent use of the F word. Hopefully that is not the kind of thing that would constitute harassment. If it does, we're going to have 85% more cases than we have right now. Gestures? Yeah, but what are his gestures?
Let me make it more particular. My question, I guess, is those findings, if that's the additional context that we're looking at, what does that do to what you've termed a veiled threat? You have an effing death wish in terms of what a reasonable person, how they would interpret that in that context.
Well, I guess the answer is the context can be read both ways. As I indicated earlier, the fact that he hadn't done anything with regard to assaultive behavior would lead you to believe that all he is doing is yelling loudly, being obnoxious, but otherwise trying to convince her to get her stuff off his right of way.
So, Mr. Mack, though, our review of the district court's decision is under an abuse of discretion standard. And as we talked about before, we don't reweigh the evidence. It sounds like you're asking us to weigh it in a different way, to say, well, it could be this could just be a veiled threat, but that's not what the district court found.
Yeah, but I'm saying that the district court wouldn't have a basis for such a finding based upon the facts of this case. So I'm saying that there were not sufficient facts in this case that the judge could have made a finding of a threat to her safety. And if he couldn't have done that, then abuse of discretion doesn't come into play because the record simply doesn't support what he did. Any more questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mack. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an order within the statutory timeframe. You have a nice day.
Thank you.